Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, while water is a basic human right, some 3 billion people face water scarcity, and some countries are running out of water. We'll explore the realities of water. Barbara Cousins is a professor with the University of Idaho College of Law and the Waters of the West Graduate Program. She is the author of Indigenous Water Justice, The Adaptive Water Governance Project, and Truth or Consequences, Settling Water Disputes in the Face of Uncertainty. Rick Hochebohm also joins us. He's the executive director of the Water Footprint Network and a PhD candidate at the University of Twente in Netherlands. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the two of you with us. I've been reading in a lot of headlines and a lot of abstracts in the scholarship about the problems we're facing across the world with water, especially coming with climate change. And so I thought we should start with the scope of the problem. How bad it is? What are we seeing now? And how are things changing? Barbara Cousins, could you start?
Sure, I'd be happy to start. I think we have the intersection of two problems. Climate change is one, and that's changing not only where water is distributed, but how much at any one time, increasing extremes, so greater droughts, greater floods, and then just general trends of change within climate change that affect the kinds of crops you can grow and the way that people use water. But that's intersected with what people call the great acceleration, the fact that society is changing at an exponential rate. And that is illustrated in both population and the digital revolution. And so that changes how we live, how many of us are demanding water, and we all need water, and where we live. And so the combination of those things really means that we are going to have to adapt and adapt quickly.
So when you say the great acceleration driving some of these changes, can you specify what some of those changes are? I mean, you alluded to it with the kind of headings, but can you fill in the gaps about what we're seeing in the trends?
Climate change is one of the factors of the great acceleration. So we always have changes in climate over the long term, geologic time. But what the increased energy that humans are putting into the atmosphere is doing is causing it to occur in a human timeframe very quickly, and a timeframe that challenges our ability to adapt. The same is true of population. Population grows exponentially. And so to be able to provide safe drinking water globally is a challenge, even if the water supply is not changing. This just compounds it. And then our economies are changing at an accelerating rate through globalization and through the digital revolution. And so what that does is changes where we want to live, changes our daily routines, changes how we use water. So in many ways, it's not just a challenge posed by change, but by the rate of change. It's a rate that we're not used to adapting to.
Rick Hochebohm, what would you add?
I fully agree. And I would even go one step further, that even though it is tempting to attribute the water issues that we face to climate change, is that this great acceleration, as Professor Cousins framed it, is maybe even the major driver at this moment. We have growing economies, we have growing populations, and our modern lifestyles require a lot of water. And that is actually driving the water demand, which is overexploiting our resources.
You've started measuring or finding ways to measure what you're calling the footprint, the water footprint. And you've talked about in your work and with your co-authors about the industries and the demands that are causing the greatest sort of depletion of our access to good, clean, quality water. Can you walk us through what some of these are?
We indeed use the water footprint, as we call it, which is basically a measure, an indicator of water use, water consumption, because simply speaking, you cannot manage what you cannot measure, right? So we need to know how much water we are using and what we are using it for and when we are using it. And only when we know that, we can compare it to how much we have available, basically doing some bookkeeping with water rather than money. And then we can see where problems arise. And well, if you do this accounting exercise, you can do it on numerous scales. We mainly focus on the global scale. So we take more like a bird's eye view to see how we as a world population use and allocate our water. We see most of it is, of course, used in agriculture to grow the crops, to grow the food and the cotton, the food we eat, the clothes we wear. So that's definitely the sector where we use water most.
What can you tell us about the oil industry compared to other industries?
In general, I can say, though, that industry is maybe not as much a water consumer in terms of actually consuming the fresh water, but more a source of pollution.
So then one of the things, Barbara, you've talked about then is, well, how do we manage this, these changes that are going on, and how our thinking about these things are changing. So let's tie this into, so we've got water footprint that Rick is talking about, like how do we measure water? How do we know what we're up against? And then governance, on the other hand, how do we govern the system? What has been the governance system so far, and how is our thinking about that changing?
Well, it certainly varies across the globe, but as water becomes more scarce, so that's with all of the things you mentioned, just the increasing population and increasing uses, increasing demand for water. As that grows, you have to be more and more careful about how you manage water. So one aspect of that is having a much deeper understanding of where you're using water and what you're using it for. So our water governance varies globally, but in general, when you don't have scarcity, you don't have to be that careful about how you govern. So as scarcity increases, we have to tighten up on the way that we're managing water. And a real challenge, there's a twofold challenge to that. One is to do so in a way that you aren't increasing marginalization of certain communities, that you're not creating or exacerbating the haves and have-nots. It's very easy for economic systems to ignore certain sectors of the population. And the second thing that you have to do as you're tightening up on governance is just be more careful about how you distribute it. And that gets back to a lot of what Rick was talking about, knowing who's using what water where and how they're using it. And I guess I would throw in a third thing. The third thing is, with increasing rate of change, we have to do that in a way that's more adaptable. And that's not what we've done in the past. We've relied on the historic record of water supply in order to determine how to distribute it. As that changes, we have to be ready to adapt.
And so as we are thinking about adapting to this, what are you seeing emerging as new possible ways to govern?
Well, I've been studying what's going on in the United States, and what you see is at the sort of grassroots level, the level that's closest to the use of the resource, whether it's fishermen, river rafters, or irrigators, that they've become frustrated with the lack of ability to adapt and the fact that we don't integrate the way we manage water across sectors. We look at water quality in one place, we look at species at risk in another place, and we look at water allocation at another level. And so there have started to be processes that often start from the ground up, but sometimes they're triggered by a governmental process or imposition of a governmental regulation, where people come together and work to resolve conflict in more of a holistic way and come up with solutions that end up being watershed-wide or basin-wide and look at the system more broadly.
So Rick Hochobohm, let's bring you back in here, because your organization actually also looks at this adaptive governance. What would you add to this?
Well, it seems to me that the focus of measures to reduce water issues or water scarcity is usually focused on efficiency. If only we can install water-saving shower heads, for instance, we can reduce our footprint. And efficiency in agriculture by going to different irrigation techniques it's all good, but it's not enough to just make an efficiency gain on all these terrains. We should also see how much we have in absolute terms available in a watershed, which is the most typical unit of measurement that we use in hydrology. But of course, you have all the difficulties of scale, transboundary basins, where that is all very difficult. But still, we have to widen our scope to not only focus on small efficiency gains, but also see what system we're part of. And that even extends beyond the basin scale. It's not even how much water we only have available on the basin, but also how do our lifestyles depend on water that is coming from all over the world. In our globalized economy, we import stuff, goods and services from all over the place, and it consumed water or it polluted water at the places of production. So our whole system, our whole lifestyle is connected to all these activities worldwide, making it basically a global problem, which is, of course, very difficult to solve.
Yeah. I wonder also, Barbara, you had hinted in one of your books, not just hinted, I mean, you wrote about this a bit in terms of international governance. Already there are some things in place on the international level, but I'm a political scientist, so I'm also aware of the conflicts that are arising between countries over water and water scarcity, damming rivers, so one country gets it, the other doesn't, one country having swimming pools, the other country not being able to even get water out of their groundwater systems. What is currently in place globally, and what kind of changes are we going to need to make sure entire countries don't literally die of thirst?
You know, one of the interesting things, people that have looked at this have looked at conflict over water. There's actually only been one armed conflict over water. And more often, people resolve the conflicts over water. And I think the big question is, will that continue as we have increasing scarcity and changes with climate change? I think that the efforts that people are making at diplomacy are essential. And there are a number of examples of transboundary agreements across international boundaries that can be used as models for how you distribute water across a boundary without interfering with the sovereignty of the other country. But those efforts have to increase, and particularly in the places that climate scientists believe will be the hotspots going forward in terms of water scarcity. And I think we're not learning how to do that at the same rate that climate change is unfolding, and that's certainly concerning. These systems are connected, and what the work of some people who have worked on these transboundary water disputes have found or have pointed to as the reason why you don't tend to have armed conflict over water is it's one of these shared resources that we only hurt ourselves if we get into conflict over it. So the upstream country can use the water and prevent it from flowing downhill, and they can also pollute it and prevent it from going downhill. But the downstream country can keep migratory fish from getting up the system, and they can keep navigation from going up the system. So there tends to be this shared interest in working out these problems. And I think also this underlying norm that we recognize that humans can't exist without water. So if you deny a whole people access to water, it's the functional equivalent of genocide. And so very often we are able to stop short of actual physical conflict when we're talking about water because of these underlying reasons. And so I think there's a lot of hope there, but I think we need to get busy.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're discussing the realities of water. The other thing that you started to discuss dealt with a commercial end of it and the haves and the have-nots, and can't remember who originally said this, but when speaking about the haves saying, well, that's okay, we can always buy bottled water, you know. And then there is this whole sort of bottling industry going into regions where there is still clean water at the source, and then selling it. And How do you put this into the context of your studies, Barbara Cousins?
So let me go at that in two ways. One is sort of the haves and have-nots, and then the second is sort of how this huge bottling industry is affecting that. On the haves or have-nots, so we now have this international standard for the human right to water. And in the developed world, it's shocking. With my students, I use this standard to illustrate to them that our problems are first world problems. The human right to water is basically enough so you can have drinking water to survive. This is not taking showers. This is not watering your garden. And you can obtain it within a 0.6 mile walk. That's, none of us in the developed world live with that. And so when we're talking about the haves and the third thing, it is meets the requirements of sanitation, with which billions of people across the world do not have that level of clean water. And so when we're talking about the haves and have-nots, we're not talking about just people who are impoverished, but the possibility that huge parts of the global population will really be in dire straits as change unfolds. The water bottling problem can exacerbate that, but it's often playing out in places that are maybe at more of an intermediate level. They're not faced with not being able to obtain access to human right to water, but they are faced with potentially scarce supplies. And if you look at a map that shows the amount of groundwater available across the United States relative to freshwater surface water, it's huge. There's far more groundwater than there is surface water supply, but groundwater is not all of it renewable. Some of it is storage in place. And what we're doing with water bottling is finding some of these larger, really wonderful, pristine aquifers, and we're developing them in order to bottle water. And that water not only is sort of the buffer that the communities in those areas would have as surface water supplies change, but it's also often connected to that surface water. And so the impacts of developing that water are often not fully understood before doing it, but it's also not considered in the context of what does it mean to our adaptive capacity to not have that storage sitting there in place when surface water becomes scarce.
Rick, let's bring you back in. Rick Hochebaum, what would you say to all of this? The economics, the changing in the ecosystem, what do you see from your point of view?
Well, maybe to tap into this discussion on the bottled water, it always amuses me a little bit, because even though there may be and probably are issues, local issues where bottling plants are, I would say that this is definitely not our major concern. There's probably more water. I'm quite sure, actually, there's more water use and pollution in the manufacturing of the actual bottle than there's water going into the bottle. So it distracts maybe a little bit from the drinking water is not an issue. Even the bottled water is not, and not even the drinking water or even the water we use at home. It's in our food. It's in our diets. It's in our lifestyle. And that's where the major water consumption is, and where and what causes the problems. I don't know. Maybe it's tempting to blame bottlers or somehow for these problems. But I think it's more in the choices that we make, mainly in our diet. Take for instance meat that requires so much water. If you just do not eat one hamburger, you know, this week, just go vegetarian one day, you can shower as long as you want for the rest of the day to, you know, to balance the water consumption that you have. There's so much more water going on in your average diet than in your daily home household use. So I think it's important to keep that into perspective, that those, how do you measure in gallons? We'll say we have 120 liters a day that we use at home. There's over 4,000 liters of water going on in the food that we consume, that we eat every day. And just put it in perspective, it's just 1%.
Rick Hochebohm, you've just opened up a new area that I'm very curious about. So I know that raising certain kinds of food, animals for food in particular, is a very excessive use of water and also grains and natural resources of other types. Can you help us understand that process and why it is the case?
Well, very simply, we can either eat the grains ourselves as food, or we feed it to the animals and then eat the animals. But the conversion efficiency of the grains and feeding it to the animals and getting the same amount of calories or proteins from it is very low. So we can probably feed many more people if we would all go on a vegetarian diet. But because of our affluence, because of our choices, we can afford meat. And we eat meat, we give the crops to the animals. The water that is used to grow those crops, of course, compounds. And that also touches on these issues of equity that we were discussing a while back. That definitely adds up.
So in terms of things that people in their own lives can do, people who are concerned about the social justice issues related to water, you're saying their diet makes a big difference.
It makes all the difference. And that's probably also the best thing you can do as a consumer. I mean, it's obviously a good idea to install, as I referred earlier, to install a water-saving shower head. But you will make a much bigger impact if you change your diet, if you watch how much water goes into the product that you eat on a day-to-day basis. Probably you even save more water on the electricity or the heat. The power that you do not need to heat the water for your shorter shower than the actual amount that runs from the shower tap. So, but that's for consumers.
Barbara Cousins, what would you add to this thinking? Is this something that you consider in your scholarship?
Yeah, Rick is absolutely right that the amount of water that we consume for the production of food is far and away greater than our drinking water uses or our household uses. It exceeds it enormously. And so on a global scale, when you're thinking of the water balance of the globe as a whole, he's absolutely right that is the best thing we can do globally is change our diet. But I would also say, you know, it was once said that all politics is local. And it's also true to a certain extent that all water consumption is local. We certainly have the concept of virtual water with moving crops, selling food from one part of the world in another part of the world, or selling bottled water in another part. But when you think about adaptation and adaptive governance, it is the contextual tailored solution and the adaptive capacities of the people right within the water supply that are going to determine whether they're able to adapt to change going forward or not. And then when you look at it at that scale, there is no panacea. There is no ability to say every single watershed in the world will be better off if you change your diet or if you do something else. It's kind of the fallacy of cookie cutter solutions. We have to work on local capacity and local governance for people to be able to figure out what works within their particular watershed, what works for that particular water supply, and how it's changing.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're discussing the realities of water. Rick Hochebohm, your response?
Well, I do think it is important to keep this global connection to the local consumption of water. In the end, as water managers of a basin or even of a farm, you are using water to grow a crop or to produce a certain product. And it would be nice to know where that product is going to. If it's something for local consumption, if it's something worth the money, especially if there's not so much water, if you ship it to the other side of the world. I definitely think that that is something that we need to know so that we can act upon that. So I don't think it's a pure local issue, and it's very good to keep this global component into account as well.
I'd like to turn just a bit, Barbara Cousins, to another thing in your book, which deals with this issue of water colonization. Can you talk about what you mean when you talk about water colonization and water rights with Indigenous people?
So a lot of my work in the past has been working on water rights for Indigenous peoples, particularly in the United States. But in recent years, I've learned a lot more about Canada and Australia. And all three of those nations are ones that were colonized by Britain. And what we see, so I'll just use the United States as an example. There are our federal law recognizes that Native American tribes have rights to water. And in the last probably 30 years, we've made great strides in this country in both quantifying those water rights and providing funding to develop them. So we've moved a long way in that. But the impact of water colonization is that that's simply recognizing the right and saying, okay, good, now we can all move forward from here, is not enough. The legacy of that colonization is that not only were those rights suspended or taken away for over 100 years, but the populations that were here before European contact have been decimated. They were decimated by war, by disease, by movement onto reservations that did not have the same attributes always as homelands. And then the landscape that was relied on was changed. And so what some of the work that I've been working on more recently with others looks at is not how do we restore that? If you talk to many Native people, they would be angered by the thought that we're thinking about restoring them to some condition that existed 200 years ago, but reconciliation of that. So how do we not only recognize the rights and help in the development of that, but how can the capacity to govern and to take a seat at the table be developed among Indigenous people through their own vision, through their own Indigenous knowledge, through their own way of approaching the water resource in order to reconcile their uses with uses of others in shared watersheds?
So now if we turn to the global and we look down the road 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. I mean, already we're seeing some areas of the world running out of water, right? I just read recently South Africa is almost parts of it running out of water.
Yeah, day zero approaching.
Rick Hochebaum, what are we facing when we look down the pike 10 years, 20 years, 30 years? What do you see happening? And then let's talk about how we address that.
Well, as I mentioned, we focus mainly on the global level and see how we deal with our water. And studies that we did show that already now we have 4 billion people, so that's quite a percentage of the world population, experience water scarcity at least 1 month of the year. So that's already quite a big number, of course. And if we look at, well, where that is, of course, that is in the Middle East and near Africa, where there's not much water. They already depend on the import of their food from places where there is a lot of water. For instance, from the United States. The United States exports food and thus virtual water, mainly to Mexico and Japan, even Australia. I looked it up. You would maybe not expect it because, well, it is a largely arid country, but still they export virtual water. And the European Union imports the water, even though we have quite some water available in the region. So you can, if you can just add these flows and do a little bit of the accounting, you can see that these flows are not sustainable. Australia cannot export water very much longer. The United States cannot export water virtually then in the crops that they sell very much longer. They will use it probably for domestic consumption. So what does that mean? That means that the regions where there still is water will have to beef up their production so that they can fill in the gap for, well, the regions that already rely on importing water now, such as the Middle East, which will probably never be able to sustain or be fully self-sufficient in terms of water. So the Europe will become an exporter. Latin America will have to export more. And also in Africa, there's still quite some undeveloped potential for increasing our crop growth. So those are more the major movements that you can see going.
You mentioned the Middle East, and I know that some of the countries there have turned to desalinization. What are the effects of that?
Well, for one, it's a very expensive solution, mainly for drinking water, although I know in Israel they also use it for agriculture. But it's something that costs a lot of money, costs a lot of energy, and is not something that is, in my, what I expect, is not something that's going to be the one solution that's going to fix all our problems.
Barbara Cousins, what would you add to all this?
I guess I'd add, I agree with a lot of what Rick has said, and I agree that it's a global problem and that there are certain changes that, if they happened globally, would help considerably. But what I would add is that solutions, and particularly getting people to buy into solutions, particularly those solutions that require changes in lifestyle, are local. And it is through building local capacity and engaging in the process of dialogue and education that communities are going to begin to grapple with this and find their own ways towards adaptation.
Last words, Rick Hochebaum?
Yeah, well, I think we may even be forced to change such local diets. For instance, I didn't even mention China and India, which are at the brink of going from exporting virtual water to importing it. If they ban the export of rice because they want to feed their own population, then we will have to change our diets regardless of our local choices.
I wonder if something has to be done on an international agreement level. Barbara Cousins, do you see something like that happening?
So are you suggesting a global agreement on water? Probably 10 years ago, I would have said yes. Today, as a pragmatic approach, I don't think that's likely. But I nevertheless think that agreeing to similar things is possible when people see it in their own self-interest. And many of these solutions that Rick is suggesting are in local self-interest. And so that and the fact, which he also just indicated, which I think is really important, that in many parts of the world, people will not have a choice but to adjust, will drive these solutions forward.
It's a shared responsibility. We all will have to do our part. Consumers, we as consumers can choose what we eat, what we buy. Businesses should measure how much water they use in their particular business, especially in their supply chains. Look across the fence. Investors who shape the future of the economy of tomorrow should ask questions about water to prospective clients. Governments, of course, need to know what they allocate their water to and water management. So everyone has its role to play. It's not one international global organization, for instance, the UN, that's going to solve all this for us.
Well, Barbara Cousins and Rick Hochebaum, it has been a great pleasure hosting you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Barbara Cousins is a professor with the University of Idaho College of Law and the Waters of the West graduate program. She is the author of Indigenous Water Justice, The Adaptive Water Governance Project, and Truth or Consequences, Settling Water Disputes in the Face of Uncertainty. Rick Hochebaum also joins us. He's the executive director of the Water Footprint Network and a PhD candidate at the University of Twente in Netherlands.